This is EdgeCases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And our topic this week is cross-platform development.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, but first, Wolf, did you say you had follow-up?
I do have some little follow-up, but a couple of points of follow-up, but I need to do more research about them. It looks like I need to watch a couple hours of video for that before I can give the deep knowledge that I like to partake on the on this fine show of ours.
Okay, all right. So yeah, so after you watch some video, we will catch up with everyone on our follow up. Mm-hmm. Okay, cross platform development. I thought it was a fairly topical thing to talk about. One because it's a topic, but also because there's been a bit of a kerfuffle about developing for both iOS 6 and 7. I think, in our community recently. So I want to maybe talk a little bit about that. Apple has touted the advantages of not supporting iOS 6 at all. So just making your app support iOS 7, which is a bit of a change. I would say that before Apple, while it would tout supporting the features of a new version of the OS, Passbook or Game Center or whatever the new feature du jour was, they wouldn't necessarily stress leaving out support for old versions of the OS completely. So what's changed? And what changed is that iOS changed. They've made the new version quite a bit different than the old one in not only the APIs, although actually the APIs haven't changed that much, more in the philosophy of it. So it really is like developing for a new OS. So I want to talk about that. And let's see.
Yeah, it's interesting. The entire iOS or running iOS 6 apps on iOS 7. Seems like some apps are pixel perfect, exactly the same way as they were at iOS 6. Other ones seem to be pretty much look like iOS 6, but then they have a new keyboard, and some of them seem to just have looks like iOS 7 at all, but they. I don't think they were rewritten for it. They operate pretty much the same way. It probably just depends. And also, it's kind of, now that iOS 7 has the app auto updating, it's kind of confusing, which apps have actually been updated for iOS 7 specifically and all that. But it seems kind of weird. It's definitely kind of an incremental type thing. It's not a binary type thing.
No. Different apps have gone about it in different ways. I would say that older apps in general, at least the ones that I use, it is very clear that they don't quite match the new OS look and feel. But I'm going to be talking a little bit more about what it takes to make something match like that.
Okay.
So maybe more of the logic that you're going to need. So we'll see how it goes. Mm-hmm. And what I would say to start off with is that when you want to support multiple divergent OSs, and again, if we say, iOS 4 versus 5 wasn't really that different, but, something major like Windows versus Mac, which I want to talk about a little bit, or Mac versus iOS, or iOS 6 versus iOS 7, that those are going to require some costs from you. And I would say that if you want it to be the same OS, the same app for both, you want it to act the same way, there's going to be a cost, there's going to be a complexity to it that is, again, is interesting for me to talk about. I would say that even if you said, okay, I'm going to write a new app from scratch, if you want, a new Mac app, a complete port of the Windows app, and you write it from scratch, having them act the same way is going to impose a cost on you that is more than just the cost of writing that app again. And you'll see a little more of what I mean by that when I get into the details. But before I talk about the platform specifically, I want to talk about programming languages. So what would you say is the language of cross-platform development? And don't say JavaScript.
I would say C++.
Yeah, C++, right. So I wasn't around, or at least I wasn't programming when C was invented. So I'm kind of going by Wikipedia, as could you all, because I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes for the C language. But they say, one of the things they say in that article is, despite its low-level capabilities, the language was designed to encourage cross-platform programming. And Wolf, do you know much about the history of C?
I probably know too much about it, yes.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to talk about it then. The idea, it seemed to me, was that C was invented to help with porting Unix to other platforms. That seemed to be a fairly big part of that. And nowadays, of course, when we think of C, we think of it as being a pretty low-level language as compared to other languages that we might use. But at the time, it was higher level than what came before, which was assembly programming for each of the platforms that you wanted to use. So it was raising the bar up from the lower level that was there before it. But it gave you some things, and I don't know that much about the other languages that were around then, like Fortran or COBOL or things like that. But it seems to me that one of the big advantages of C was that it was going to be fast, that it didn't rely on Lisp. Lisp was around then, right? We're going to get mail.
It was, yes.
Lisp
has always been around.
Lisp is eternal. But Lisp was slower, right? Because it was using a virtual machine even back then.
It depends. I mean, there's compiled Lisps and stuff like that.
Okay.
So it doesn't need to be a virtual machine.
But C was good because it was both cross-platform and compiled down to the machine language level. So and it didn't have a lot of abstractions in the code that it generated. So you were still accessing memory directly. You were still using direct pointers. But again, it was abstract enough so that the logic could be used everywhere. Now, there might be a whole bunch of different areas that I'm just not thinking about right now that were different per platform in C, but the big one that I know about is the type sizes. And that's actually still affecting us today. So all the standard types have a minimum size, but not a maximum size, at least as far as I understand it. So, for example, the car type is at least 8 bits.
Yeah.
Short is at least 16 bits. So different platforms, like one platform could say, well, I want cars to be 16 bits because that's just, that'll be faster for my processor to deal with it. And so it won't be cross-platform in the sense that if you say, well, if I'm going to serialize the information in these these variables to disk, it won't be exactly the same for each platform. You need to take that into account. But it will be fast. It will work better on each platform than it would if you had to unnaturally make it all the same. One of the ways that this hits us with Mac and now on iOS is when we went from 32-bit to 64-bit, where change size, longs change size. And I'm looking at the 64-bit transition guide for Mac, the link for that, which appears to still work, so that's good, on Apple's developer site. And so 32-bit was ILP32, and 64-bit was LP64. You remember mm-hmm. that?
Yeah.
And of course, now we have to go through that again.
Yeah.
And so again, these are platform differences as far as I'm concerned.
And are you going to talk about what the I and the L and the P stand for?
I wasn't going to go into it in any great depth.
With a brief overview, the I stands for int, the L stands for long, and the P stands for pointer. And basically, it tells you what the size is of each of those, whether they're 32-bit or 64-bit.
Right, so they were 32-bit. And then when you say LP64, you say that longs and pointers upgraded to 64-bit size, whereas ints stayed the way they were. And it's interesting because, when I there were articles at the time that talked about this, and other platforms did different things when they went to 64-bit. Other platforms, like versions of Linux maybe or whatever, some of them took ints to 64-bit at the same time.
There are trade-offs, especially if you want to store pointers inside integers. If you think that you just can cast willy-nilly between them, then obviously you're going to truncate type stuff. There's some trade-offs there.
Right, and so what Apple did to try to smooth over some of this stuff is they came up with their own NS integer type, which would be 32-bit in 32-bit and 64-bit on 64-bit platforms. And just to digress for a minute, it sounds logical, right? But when you really think about it, and of course in the years that I've been dealing with NS integer types in my Mac code, I'm not entirely sure why it exists. Because, there's two pieces to it, right? There's, if you use NS integer for anything that might be serialized to disk, then you're setting yourself up for trouble. Because, at least in the early stages of the 32-bit to 64-bit transition on the Mac, there was every possibility that you would be sharing data back and forth between 32-bit machines and 64-bit machines. You might have bought a new Mac that was 64-bit, and you had to copy all your data over from your 32-bit machine. Well, now all the old data is in 32-bit, and now the new data is going to be 64-bit. And if you ever wanted to run those apps again on the old one, then the data would be missing. If you want to share files over Dropbox between 32-bit and 64-bit machines, anything like that would cause you trouble if you just used NS Integer directly to serialize that data out. But even more so, even if you say, oh, okay, I'll just use it at runtime, you know, seriously, is there any value, any numeric value, where you would think to yourself, on the 32-bit machine, I only need that value to go up to, you know, 2,147,483,647 on 32-bit, but then, you know, that ridiculously higher number on 64-bit. And it just strikes me that if you would be worried enough that you needed the greater capacity on your 64-bit system, then you probably would be worried enough that you would want to use some sort of fixed value that didn't depend on the platform anyway. And so in the end, I'm not sure Apple did us any favors by having NS Integer exist. And of course, one of the concrete, although not so important, but concrete details of this was how you have to handle format strings for things like NSLog. And I just tweeted about this recently. I said, things I don't miss from Mac 64-bit programming, Apple's ridiculous inability to handle NS Integer well in format strings. And I had some responses to that, and one of them from Greg Parker talked about, actually a response which mentioned a Greg Parker tweet about how there were certain formulas for format strings which would give me support for NS Integer and NSU Integer with no warnings.
Yeah.
But those didn't appear to be like, okay, well, here's the NS Integer type. They were just other types which happened to do what you wanted right now. That seemed to be the upshot of those things.
Interesting. I saw those format strings. I just thought they were exactly what I needed, I wouldn't be surprised if they aren't just, they happen to fit what we need right now.
They happen to fit. Well, they turn off the warnings is what they do.
Oh.
Now Apple, they don't do that deliberately. I think they do that because of whatever they happen to be right now. They don't happen to trigger those warnings as opposed to deliberately turning them on and off.
So it sounds like maybe actually the quote put in invisible air quotes here, but it sounds like actually you do, if you were doing it the quote-unquote proper way, that you actually would want to do the thing that Clang used to suggest, and I think it still does suggest that you actually want to cast to a long explicitly.
Yep.
Okay.
I think that's what Apple wants you to do. That has been in their documentation, things like that. And I just find it a little silly. So it turns out, over the long run, I'm not a big fan of NS Integer, but there you go. And anyway, so C has some gotchas, but it's fast and it's mostly compatible, and it works. But what it doesn't have is OO, which is why it isn't the language that I used for all the cross-platform stuff I've done in the past. Again, I've used C++, as you mentioned. And before OS X, C++ was the OO language people used to write Mac apps. And I think it strikes me right now, because you get a lot of hate from, you get a lot of disrespect from a lot of Cocoa developers for C++ these days. And again, were they just not around when the rest of us were writing Mac apps in C++? Have they blanked it out? Did they really just hate it at the time? I didn't get a lot of hate at the time from C++. It was just what you did. And I also, I did talk in the September 2012 show, Then You're Just Writing C++, with friend of the show, Uwe Kirsterer, about C++ in edgecasesshow.com/17. Wow, 17?
Yeah,
a long 17. Time ago. So people mock it's more Byzantine features, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, but you shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And again, it's what we used to write Mac and Windows apps back in the day. So let's talk about Windows and Mac. Now, Apple of today wants you to write just for their platforms, right? They famously shut out Flash apps from iOS, Flash being a major way developers were planning on writing cross-platform apps. And of course, Apple even pushes you just to write iOS 7 apps, for example, not even to support 6. So they want you to write exactly what they do, as opposed to supporting a variety of platforms. But in the old days, the attitude was quite different. So macOS had, 1-2% market share at that point?
Something like
and
that.
I think now they're actually not necessarily, you know, it's not like they're at 50% now. They're at, 5 or 10%?
But I forget what it is, but it's been doing a lot better lately.
It's been doing better, and I think they've got much better Muncher simply because of iOS's success. But of course, back in the day, it was really small, and it was shrinking. So Apple was fighting to get developers to write for their platform. And so Apple put a lot of effort into things like Java, or things like, Ruby or Python or whatever. All these things that were going to be, you know, the same on Mac and on other platforms, so that developers would come in and write things that would work there.
Yeah, Apple was a big tent back then.
It was big tent, right. So, and Java especially was interesting. I mean, Apple put a lot of effort into it. They touted it as being, you know, hey, we're the best Java platform, the most standard, whatever. And what I remember from that is that regular users still pretty much stayed away from Java apps. They were slow, they were weird looking. But ironically, the last bastion of Java apps on the Mac is developers, right? Like app code written in Java. Yeah, of course, it really looks like it. And we have another episode where I talk about that, which I don't have written down, so I can't think of it offhand. A little slice of Windows in my IDE. I don't remember the exact number. I'll put it in the show notes.
Number 12.
Okay. So, but Apple doesn't do that anymore. And it's interesting because, again, as I said, Mac is still a really tiny percentage of the market. You know, maybe 10%, 5%, whatever it is. But it still takes you, you know, 50% of the effort. You know, it takes you double the effort to write a Mac app. You know, you're still writing virtually the entire app to match a Windows app. So it kind of struck me as being a little weird that a lot of that insecurity that everyone seemed to feel back then doesn't seem to be in existence anymore, even though the costs are still pretty much the same. And of course, one of the ways that people tried to reduce the cost of Mac and Windows doing both platforms at once was by having a shared data model, having a shared sort of business logic layer so that you could write that once and it would be the same for both platforms. And of course, as we just talked about, you would write that in C and C++. And even today, if you're going to have that shared layer, you probably still want to write it in C++. If you're primarily sharing with Windows, because again, it's something that you can share, even if your UI code is now in Objective-C. So let's see, where was I here? But of course, the UI needs to be totally different. Now, one of the things that blows my mind about this is that while if you're doing a Mac and a Windows app, you can share that business layer. You can't really do that. You can't practically do that anymore with the other major platform that Apple is competing against, which is Android. Now, so my understanding, I haven't programmed in Android myself, but my understanding is that while there are extensions to support C and C++ in Android applications, you know, your primary language is supposed to be Java. So, and they don't really expect you to have a lot of logic in C++. I think they primarily expect C and C++ and maybe even just C to be there for games and for the kind of specialized speed you would need for gaming
things.
And so you can't really do that anymore. And I don't know how people do it. I don't know how this stuff works. I think what might be happening now then for that reason is that people are putting that shared logic not inside the application in a business logic layer, but on the web. So if you need shared stuff, you're getting all of that from the server. But in either case, so you have this shared layer, and there are going to be problems with that. There are going to be issues with that will, you know, that are going to happen regardless of exactly which language you use or where it is. Because what you're going to want to have in that layer is creating your data model objects is you're going to want to do that, you know, the same for all your platforms, but the capabilities and the features and the workflow of your model are going to depend heavily on what the UI needs to do with it. So we talked about how Xcode 5 with auto layout avoided wizards, right? that they gave you this sort of more complex capability without ever forcing you into a modal, you know, window where you had to keep pressing next to set up everything about a particular constraint or a set of constraints for a view or for a window. But, you know, let's say you wanted to support auto layout in a version of Xcode for Windows. Well, you might say, well, on Windows, they're, you know, they love wizards. Windows loves wizards. Wizards love Windows, whatever. Sounds like a bumper sticker. And so you might say, well, okay, so to make it a more native Windows app, well, all right, we're going to put this into a wizard. Well, that means that your constraint data model will be creating the objects that it needs differently for both platforms. And you wouldn't want your data model to not match that. So let's say, you know, if you created the constraints for a view, or you created a view through a wizard, your data model would want to be such where it says, okay, gather up all the information and then bam, make yourself a constraint or a set of constraints. Whereas on the Mac side, you want to move it more open. You want to say, well, okay, you've made it, but now there's a valid state and an invalid state. And we're going to, you know, we're going to provide the UI with information about what's invalid and what's valid. Whereas on the Windows side, it would, no, there's no invalid state. It's a building state versus a finished state. And actually, you could kind of consider this to be the difference between Xcode 4 and Xcode 5, right? The different ways that they worked. Well, so you need different things out of your data model, depending on the platform. And yet, of course, having one single data model was supposed to mean that the data model could stay the same for both platforms. So what do you do? Well, you know, there's a couple of different ways that you could make it work. You could, and this is not necessarily for this example, but this is for other examples too. Well, you could say the different modes are something platform specific. So you could abstract out some sort of delegate or some sort of extra thing where, you know, the data model could handle either state, but then sort of this extra platform specific model part could handle, you know, they could tell you, hey, here's what you can actually do for this platform. That's going to add complexity. It's going to make it harder to maintain, harder to refactor. You could just throw both in there and have it not, you could have different modes within your data model. One of the problems with that, and that's something that I see a lot in data models, is I see lots of things where you basically combine all the platform's logic into the one set of code. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, lots of if-else things. Oh, if Mac, then do this. If Windows, then do this. You know, in the midst of a 50-line block of code that's otherwise all cross-platform code, all generic code. And that, you know, that also makes it very difficult to refactor. Because if you say, well, I want to really change how this all works, now you've got to go to each platform and make sure that the thing that you're, you know, all the little details, all the extra bits of code that are in there, they're stuck in there. Like grit in pool of oil or something. Our metaphors continue to be wonderful here.
I was going to go for moss in the grill. But okay, yeah. I like both of ours, yeah.
You know, it just makes it very difficult to go further. And I'm not just saying this in the abstract. I've seen it happen where you just grind down your shared layer to the point where it's just very hard. You know, this thing that was supposed to make it easier for you to work faster actually winds up being an anchor to making things new that will work for you. Another area that I've seen this lead to problems in is error logic. If you're going to have your data model layer spit out errors back to you, which you probably wanted to do, then you've got to worry about how they're going to be used by your two platforms. So for example, you want an error which says, you know, your username is too short, or your password doesn't have enough characters in it, or it has the wrong logic or whatever. It says the wrong number of, you know, special characters, whatever. Well, you probably don't want to have that code be cut and pasted in your Mac and Windows code or anywhere else, because then when you want to change it, you need to, you know, maintenance-wise, you'd need to make sure you change it the same in both places, and that always fails, right? You always have little things always creep into different directions when you try to do that. But if you try to say, okay, well, the business logic layer will take care of that, then how do you display the error? Because Mac and Windows have different layouts for their alerts. And again, this is not abstract. I had to deal with this at one company, that we had a business logic layer that attempted to show the logic on the Mac side, and it was written by a Windows developer, and they got it wrong. They put the buttons on the wrong side.
Oh, you mean try to show the error?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and OK was like, you know, capital O, lowercase k.
Oh, I hate that.
Because that's what Windows does, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's the same kind of problem, you know, with slightly different details. Well, you could, you know, work with just codes, error codes, and have the clients all write their own text for it. That's a lot of extra text. It's a lot of extra verbiage. So that's, you know, a lot of redundant information. So that could slow you down. You could have a system whereby there's a standard set of data, and then, you know, you can diverge from it for each platform if you wanted to. That would keep the data down from being, you know, completely redundant. But it would that's a much more complicated system, and presumably people would get it wrong. In the future, people would say, oh, I don't quite understand all this complexity, and then, you know, they put the wrong data in the wrong place. There's always a cost for how you want to do that. So I don't have a great solution there. Now, one thing that I've seen is, you know, especially like if you say, well, there's an error code. Now there's a new error code, let's say, from the server. So the, you know, now I need to update the clients. If we have the clients write that logic, write that text, then you have to issue new clients. You have to put a new app on the App Store, for example, to deal with this logic. And one way that I've seen people try to get around that is where they say, well, instead of the server just giving you the error code, the server could give you the view, right? So I've seen this quite a bit, and people say, well, we want to reduce the time it takes to do things for two platforms. Well, we'll just send you a web view.
Okay.
With all that on it. And that leads to the same sort of problems, where you need to make sure the web view looks different on the different platforms. And I've seen people who sort of swore, no, we can make it look exactly like a Mac. Well, you know, no, you can't. not with web views as I know them. Anyway, you can make them look really close, but you can't make them look like it exactly. Now, it does get around the problem that you know, again, needing to go through the App Store, needing to wait a couple weeks for all that to happen. But it also means, you know, it's less work. If you don't have to have two different programmers on the Mac and the Windows side writing all this extra logic to do your native error handling, and you just have to, you know, run the same strings through, you know, a cross-platform, you know, server-side library that makes the web view, you know, that's easy, it's fast, whatever. I would not even necessarily disagree with someone who said, well, for our company, for our users, for certain segments of the population, no one's going to care, and it will let us get our stuff up faster. Not even going to argue that, because you know what? It's true. It's going to be true for certain segments of the population, certain kinds of apps.
That's very, very adult of you.
I don't want to work on those kind of apps.
Right.
But it's true. And I would also say, you know, a lot of companies don't get the Mac. And so instead of them trying to fight it, instead of them trying to say, you know what, no, because of iOS, now we've got to go native with everything. You know, no, don't kill yourself for that. Do what you do best. And actually, that's the other thing. Like, if you're spending all this time with these apps and it's getting more complicated and more crufty and more, you know, bogging you down, you know what? Just do a website. And I think that's actually become less acceptable, I guess, in the community now, because especially with iOS, you know, people, everybody seems to want a native iOS app. And that may still be true. And maybe some of this is self-aggrandizing or self-serving, because, you know, I do iOS development now and not Mac development. But, you know, I have seen this. I have seen people struggling, companies struggling with this when they really shouldn't. Like, because it's easier, I think, for most companies that are cross-platform to do web apps and do them well than to do Mac apps and do them well. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, just don't fight it. Yeah. So I guess that's, you know, so if you find yourself saying, well, we got to put web apps in our Mac view, you know, just do a website and make that work. I also think it's interesting that, thought keeps giving my mind. Oh, that, like, again, people today, you know, Cocoa developers especially, again, they seem to have sort of lost sight of the fact that they lost sight of that Windows Mac battle, which was, again, such a big part of our consciousness in, a couple of years ago. But that almost no company today that's putting out a desktop app that's not just, you know, like a two-person company that does Cocoa apps, they still can't afford to ignore Windows. They still can't just put out a Mac app. You know, so this thing, which feels like such an old battle now, is still totally there and is still totally an issue that you can't just put out a Mac app. You've got to put out a cross-platform app. And so, and a lot of companies are still doing that. So you have all of these problems that I just talked about. They're still there. They're still a vital issue. They're still vitally important to these companies, which oftentimes don't have the resources to do everything that you would ever want for all these platforms. Mm-hmm. So, and again, it seems like we're getting to the point where, you know, native apps are really important again. But again, just, you know, do a website. A lot of, you know, 99% of the time with these companies that are struggling with this, with companies that are going to put out crappy Mac apps. No, I'd rather have a web app that's decent than a crappy Mac app today. And it's still an issue. But again, the thing that's more visible today to most Cocoa programmers is the divide between Mac and iOS. And what's interesting here is that it should be a divide which is easier to cross than Mac Windows. Because in Mac and Windows, I mean, they're very different OSs. They came from different companies, came from different philosophies. Whereas Mac and iOS, you know, they share so much, right? They share the same HIG, I think, at least in some degree. They share the same language. You can write your shared layer in Objective-C instead of in C++. Networking layer is pretty much the same. But of course, the big problem is that, you know, the UI works very differently. So you are still forced, even though you got a lot of similarities, you are still forced to write almost completely different UI layers for both. But I think it's even more than that. It seems to me, not necessarily for a lot of the user-focused apps, like Tweetbot is one example, although I think I'll get back to that in a second, where, you know, if you had a Mac version and an iOS version, they're pretty much going to do the same thing. But that's because it's a fairly small app. It's more that you've taken the iOS app and making it a Mac app rather than saying, well, they're two completely standalone apps. I think for most companies that are trying to provide a service, the Mac app and the iOS app are going to be very different because you can print more stuff in the Mac app. You can put more functionality in there. And if you have a business where it's important that your app provides you with the support for your service, the support for your business model, you're going to want to put more in the Mac app. So it's more of a philosophical issue than just APIs. So that's always, that's been interesting to me. It's interesting how there has not been as much convergence as I might have otherwise thought in the apps that I've been involved with. But we can get back to Tweetbot now. Like the Mac version and the iOS version of Tweetbot are very, very similar. And of course, that's because what they basically did was they backported it to the Mac. And I believe, I mean, it looks like they used some sort of library to make, to be able to use more of the iOS look and feel on the Mac side. They didn't say, well, we're going to make an entirely new Mac port that just feels entirely like a native Mac app. They made a Mac port which looks very much like an iOS app. And it's interesting because back in the day, Mac users were very concerned about Windows ports that felt like Windows on the Mac.
Right.
Right? And they were very concerned about it. They were very worried about it. They really wanted companies that ported their apps to the Mac to spend the time to make it a real Mac app. And I think we've been hearing some of the same sorts of grumblings about iOS apps that look like iOS on the Mac. But I don't see quite as much of that sense of concern and ridicule, and actually, you know, and behind that, the fear that we saw for Windows. And I guess it's because, you know, if there's going to be a dominant platform over Mac, at least the other dominant platform is one we admire, right? It's iOS, we admire it, it's from Apple, it's from our friends, and so we can handle that. But it really does point out to me, I think, that when you have these cross-platform battles, when you have these cross-platform issues, there's almost never an equal playing field. It's almost always that one platform is dominant and the other platform is secondary. And, you know, we saw it with Windows and Mac. We're now seeing it with iOS and Mac. And I think one of the reasons we get so much commentary about Android, where we get these Mac aficionados, Apple aficionados, who are so desperate to point out that even though Android has, you know, a much higher market share now, it's growing faster, everything else, that somehow iOS is still in the running and is still as good, that the market share doesn't matter as much as you might otherwise think it would. And I think some of that is coming from people realizing that if it really gets to the point where developers need to put Android first, the apps that will then come out of that for iOS from that paradigm are going to look and feel more like Android apps than iOS apps. Mm-hmm. Because they're going to be the dominant platform. That's what you're going to do less to make them look like iOS apps. I think that's where a lot of that fear comes from. And I think it's probably kind of warranted.
Yeah.
Because that's the way it's going to happen. So yeah, fun. And then the last thing I want to talk about, I guess real quicker, was iOS 6 versus iOS 7. And I think iOS 7, as we've talked about, iOS 7 is Apple's way to try to claw itself back to relevance again. And, you know, pulled out all the stops. But what it really did was it changed the philosophy behind it. If you look at their transition guides, they have Apple loves transition guides. So there's iOS 7 transition guide. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And it's, you know, it talks about the deference, clarity, depth, all of these things that they want you to focus on. And that's why it's the fact that they changed the philosophy is why they feel like different platforms. Because actually the APIs haven't really changed that much. They've added some more APIs, but of course they've added APIs in previous versions as well. So why is this different? It's different because they want you to make your app look and act different in the way that you would for a different platform than just where you want to add a new feature. Now, I thought I saw in the WWDC sessions that Apple is really pushing for you to just do iOS 7. What's interesting in the transition guide, there's much less of that. And in fact, if you look at the transition guide sort of section for supporting iOS 6, there isn't really a big heavy-handed, oh my God, don't do this, you know, set of text, at least not that I saw with my quick reread of this. Instead, there's a lot of really helpful advice. You know, they talk about using auto layout because auto layout gives you some extra capabilities in terms of iOS 6 versus iOS 7 differences. They talk about how Interface Builder will let you preview the app as an iOS 6 app versus an iOS 7 app. Very helpful. A couple of other things there as well. So in fact, even if the top level line is, oh my God, don't support iOS 6, they actually are providing a decent amount of help to do that. And a decent amount of good advice too. Wolf, you've probably read this, but they say, you know, the relative difficulty level of doing it is depends on what philosophy you took in your iOS 6 app. If your iOS 6 app is either using all custom functionality, like say Tweetbot did, or using all system functionality or look and feel, then you're better off than if you tried to tweak the system feel, you know, use most of it, but then do a little bit of it different for yourself. Well, you know, that second model, the third model, whatever, is the one that's going to cause you the most problem because, you know, you tweak something which is now radically changed out from under you. But they did, you know, again, they sort of walk you through it. They say what you need to do and why you need to do it. So, and I also say this as someone who has been working on an app which is iOS 6 and iOS 7. And, you know, again, it depends on how much you want to embrace that new philosophy. Will lead to your level of difficulty. If you don't, if you do something which is pretty much can act the same on both, and I do think that's possible, then, you know, you're not going to have that bad of a time, is what I've seen so far in my experience. And that's all I have to say at this point about cross-platform development. Wolf?
Okay, well, I have a few notes that I've built up as you were speaking. Mm-hmm. First, it's funny that we used to, back in the day of the Microsoft dominance, that we used to make fun of Microsoft, at least in my little group, that Microsoft would talk about cross-platform code bases, and by that they meant Windows 95, Windows 98, and Windows NT.
Yeah.
I'm glad that when you were talking about cross-platform, you actually meant non-Apple platforms as well. But yeah. I also agree that the differences between iOS and the Mac, that definitely is also a cross-platform issue. But at least it's not from the same vendor. In terms of your talking about C++ as kind of like being able to be kind of this backbone of a shared code base between various platforms. Yeah, those were definitely the golden days when you had your Windows app, you had your Mac app, and they both were coded through and through in C++. Those days are sadly, or not so sadly, long behind us. It's funny that on Windows, obviously C# is the preferred language. On the Mac, Objective-C, and Android Java. And in some ways, it's good because it's like you look at like cocoa bindings. Maybe isn't the best example, but the idea that if the operating system has knowledge about your data model, they can do a lot of stuff for you. And so that's kind of the story behind Core Data. And of course, Windows has theirs, and Android has theirs, and all that. And it makes sense that you actually want these application frameworks to have deep knowledge about your domain objects, your business logic objects type of stuff, because they can do more for you. Because yeah. These are common patterns that repeat. But of course, they're all tied into their own little platforms, and that makes it much harder to share it across platforms. One thing I did want to mention that I'm not doing a recommendation, but I thought was pretty interesting, is that Google came out with a tool called J2OBC, which is basically a transpiler
Java
to Objective-C. It's a little bit it's more than a transpiler. It looks like it has like they do some Java runtime environment emulation where they have some.
Yes.
Some stuff that's, I assume those are basically lightweight wrappers around the Objective-C classes. But this is actually kind of interesting to me, the idea that you kind of take this, for lack of a better term, I'll call it a lowest common denominator language like Java, which is definitely not the case because it has features that Objective-C doesn't have and vice versa. But the idea is that you can kind of take this kind of dumb language like Java and then transpile it into a platform-specific language like Objective-C. And, I mean, if you have straight-up business logic where you're not doing fancy, like, you know, obviously Objective-C has for, like, real message sending, and Java doesn't. But if you don't require that, and you kind of write up straight-up OO code like you'd do in C++, say, this might be reasonable. And I'll give you a link there so you can put in the show notes, Andrew.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Not that I recommend it. As a matter of fact, in the little homepage, they say that we are a small team and we appreciate any help you can give us. So it's, I mean, the fact that it comes from Google does not mean that this is, has the full weight of Google behind it, that this is what they're recommending you do or anything like that. Sounds like this is like a little skunkworks thing that happened to make it outside of the Google veil. And it's just, I would say it's more interesting than anything.
Sure.
In terms of I agree with you that there's been this entire native drive where companies that don't have the software development talent are trying to build and create and design native apps for every platform when the web would suit them just fine. The nice thing about the web is that the web is its own platform and people understand it and they understand that it's not a Mac app. They understand it's not a Windows app. They understand it's the web. It's its own thing. And so a lot of the things where you like are trying to make something look like the Mac, those problems will simply go away because people understand, oh, this is just a web thing. To a limited extent, you can deal with this with what I call exoskeleton technology, which is essentially taking kind of web-ish type things and putting in native wrappers. On the iOS, they have things like PhoneGap, which I guess actually PhoneGap is across the board. I think they recently renamed PhoneGap also, so I probably need to catch up with that. But the idea is that you have a native app that's basically gives you so that like if you need to read the accelerometer that you can't do in JavaScript, you can use PhoneGap that will provide the Objective-C glue that you can now do it in JavaScript. Still not recommending that, but it's an interesting way to take web technology and give it the little hooks to the native platform that allow your web app to do that little extra more that allows it to play better on the platform. Inside our little purist bubble, technology like PhoneGap tend to be really looked down upon. But I think it's as adult business, you actually need to seriously look into it. And if you're a small company that needs to target all the platforms, you have limited resources, and you can't do the quote unquote right job because you just don't have the funds for it, then this is I'd rather have your app available at all than not have it available at all. Which I think our purist camp might say, oh no, your app shouldn't be there at all. But I prefer to have the app available. Yeah. And it's interesting when you mentioned the Tweety UI and the backporting type stuff. I'm sorry, the Tweetbot UI. I've always been an anti-fan of the Tweety UI that I feel has kind of infected Mac apps. I'm a big fan of Tweety. I bought the app when I was Tweety 1 and Tweety 2, and I really enjoyed it.
Tweety or Tweetbot?
Tweety.
Okay.
So that type of UI. Lauren is obviously a genius. When Tweety arrived on the Mac, I instantly disliked it. I thought it as something foreign. And I was dismayed when I saw that type of UI, which is kind of like, and let's take the bottom tab bar and move it along the side of the app, and let's kind of like put all this navigation stuff into the small little window, and basically as a way of porting iOS apps onto the Mac. And basically, this kind of provided a design language for this type of taking iOS apps and moving it to the Mac without having to rethink very much about the idea that you have a big screen, you have multiple windows, this type of stuff.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And I was quite dismayed how it caught on like wildfire that this is, and it's very, very kind of trendy type stuff. And I just don't think it fits the Mac. And unfortunately, I think the popularity has been waning a little bit, which I'm happy for. But it kind of makes me think that when we were talking about, I think this goes to one of our original episodes when we were talking about what they call it, iCode. Like
right.
When it's interesting because Xcode to me, even when it's with this Xcode 4 kind of unified UI, unified window UI, it's very much a Mac app.
It's still right? A Mac app, right?
Still a Mac app. It's going to be really interesting when and I don't put an if in this, when Apple releases Xcode for iPad or Xcode. It has to be by iPad. I don't see how they could fit it into
the phone, right?
But when they do. I think that's when the real crunch is going to come because Xcode will become iCode ported to the Mac, and that's when the real fun is going to begin. When you think that Xcode 4 was constraining us in terms of trying to put everything into one window and it not working well, imagine once you're dealing with an iPad interface on your Mac port, and there's no way to break out of that.
Yeah,
well, so that's what we have looking forward to.
When they said that the iWork apps, the new iWork apps are backports of the iOS. So yeah, I mean they're totally doing it with other apps already. I mean I think the difficult part will be getting Xcode shrunk down to iPad size. The backport will be inevitable after that, but I think until they can get it shrunk down like that, then we're safe. I think from that fate of that sort of thing.
Again, as we talked about in that what they called iCode episode, which I think was episode two. We go way back, and I feel kind of badly for recommending it because our audio quality was pretty bad back then. But so maybe I'll just mention it here, so that way we don't have people having to drug up that episode and listen
no,
to us.
Stay away.
That it's quite possible that Apple does have more of a server-side kind of component, and that you actually will host your source code with Apple, and that will and then this becomes a quick like little UI display issue. Of course, it has very many intended issues with the fact that you actually store your source code with Apple and all that. But like I said, you know, the red carpet leads right there. That I mean, we've put up with a lot. I suspect that people will scream about it and then do it.
Yep. Okay. Well, on that note, to see the show notes for this episode, go to edgecasesshow.com, all one word, /66, and we'll see you next time.